Chapter 8. Feast of Swarming Flies. A group of people stood near the shore of the mainland.
Shivra Nyarl is out there?
They were all looking at Cowtip Island from a distance.
Yes, he is there, and soon, we shall be too.
Rafferjee spoke with confidence to Khans. A couple of days ago, the group, led by de facto leader Rafferjee, was beginning to embark. Staring at the waters between themselves and the island, the group stirred like the wind in their view.
Why Cowtip?
Hass Lodi was naturally curious, as his expertise lie in the vicious experimentation on living subjects with chemicals. Defay Volkor came in with her patented speed.
Who cares?
Being the group's longest-standing striker, she only cared about killing Shivra quickly. This was to Kalnz's chagrin, however.
I'm with Hass. We can't be too careful. What if it's a trap? Cowtip would be a clever pit to lure us into. He's got to know that someone is after him, so why not pigeonhole everyone?
That's not the reason, though.
Sony Ishikawa knew, due to his connections, exactly what was going on with him.
Cowtip Island is the only province of the United Provinces of Imperium Exigenes to not directly border one of the other provinces. Also, it is the only non-mainland province, meaning exiting the country is much easier. The other two provinces would likely be informed of what is going on and be monitoring any border crossings. Cowtip is the easiest way for him to disappear from their traces.
Thank you, Sony.
Kometa Aster was treated more as the leader than Rafa, who is only considered the lead as he was the sole founding member. Kometa was viewed and treated as the leader because of how benevolently she treated the rest of the group. No one questioned any leadership, however, as they were not rigidly defined roles. Also, any order Rafa gave was followed because of his track record. Rafa and Kometa's romantic relationship also helped solidify a leadership role for the couple. Everyone else in the group had little care for leading. They were mostly happy for the tasks they'd be given on a mission. This mutual benefit is how the group was started.
Wait, so how did it get to Cowtip?
Jeremiah felt like he was missing something.
Isn't there only a narrow travel season from all the storms?
Rafa only knew the answers because of the information disseminated by Sony.
Sony, would you care to enlighten Jeremiah?
It's quite simple, really. He swam.
What Sony said was shrill to Kalnz's ears.
We're not doing that, are we? That's impossible.
Diom took it as a challenge.
Shivra did it. So can we.
Sonny corrected him.
Well, Shivra is a bit of a different case. Besides, maybe some of us could, but not everyone here would make it. Rafa will show you what we're going to do.
Rafa began leading the group on a walk to a dock. Along the way, Dreadlaw noticed Maida's silence. Maida was usually quiet, but it was his words he abandoned, not everything else. Normally, it wasn't hard to see Maida's distaste over the group's more vocal personalities interrupting the smooth display of detail with a shrug or other form of bodily language. Today, he seemed apathetic. Law was a newer member of the group, but he was very in tune with Maida, as they spent quite some time fighting alongside each other. He knew better than to ask any questions, though. Law wasn't the only one who noticed. Kometa had her finger on the pulse of the entire group. She made it her constant objective to make sure the group didn't devolve into infighting. Later she'd bring it up to Rafa, though he wouldn't pay it much mind, as per his usual. He was more focused on how to properly utilize the abilities of each member, and maximizing effectiveness while minimizing risk. The group entered the dock, where Defay blurted with excitement,
"How'd you get this?"
"A submarine. Impressive."
Even Law was surprised. Sonny made sure to explain.
"You think the UPIO would just leave transport to one of their only three provinces for such a brief period a year? No way. In case of emergencies, the government would use babies like this to travel between Cowtip and the mainland."
Hass was still unquenched with that answer.
"But how did you get this?"
"Who do you think posted that open invitation to taking down Shivra?"
Rafa knew from the moment he heard about Shivra's strength. Sonny didn't need to explain this to the group. Law had his suspicions, but it was rare for a government to sanction the killing of any citizen. UPIO's grasp on their news outlets was tight enough to not let any media get a hold of this fact, however, despite experienced individuals like Law and Rafa figuring it out on their own. Who knew how far this knowledge had spread? How short of a range it had? A small crew emerged to greet their passengers. One of them informed the rest of the plans. This news was not satisfying to everyone in the group. They explained,
"We'll drop you off there and leave.
This is one of the last subaquatic vehicles in use in the UPIO, and we can't have it tied up in private matters. It will need to be back in the dock on the mainland in case anyone else needs to travel to Cowtip.
It was necessary, however. A country can't trust the private sector with key equipment in a time like this. If the UPIO needed to send anyone to Cowtip for the matter of Shivra Niyal or any economic reasons, the sub would be needed. Furthermore, if the media somehow got wind of the sub being missing, they'd demand explanation. When it comes to Nen, certain reporters and journalists are especially skilled in sneaking into locations and posting the information online. It could be a whole can of worms for the UPIO to have to explain the sub's whereabouts and intrigue others into pondering what reason, regardless of explanation. Rafa and the rest knew they'd have to find their own way back during travel season. Back on Cowtip, present day, Tolver was leading Maxwell and the rest of Group 1 towards Fisher's Paradise, so that they may leave the island before the storm hits. There were three others in Group 1, making it smaller than Group 2, which had six people. This was done on purpose, as Tolver was a fan of making himself a diversion for the other group to escape. Maxwell was stuck in this group, diversionary tactics and all, because he was new to their operation. Tolver wanted to keep Maxwell close to himself, both to keep an eye on and to ensure his safety firsthand. It was as much Tolver gaining Maxwell's trust as it was a matter of finding trust in Maxwell. Group 1 was taking a path through the northern section of Cimeterium, while Group 2 was taking a path down the southern border of Cimeterium, just inside the city's limits, so as not to expose themselves by traveling through the forest. The forest may provide cover, but as they had seen not one but two officers enter the ridge floor village from the forest, that plan was forgotten. It was a tense happening when Lamino walked by them. Though nothing came of it, the group remained in hiding, as yet another police officer had stepped through along the same path Lamino took. It was Detective Blound, closing in. In his tunnel vision of finding Lamino, Blound didn't notice any signs of heavy traffic to and from the buildings that Lamino had passed. He passed right by the gambler's hideout as he followed. It was still apparent to Blound, though, to check out the village while he was here, as there must have been some reason for Lamino to be sent to this village, he assumed. One possibility was as a diversion, but another was that there was some location here that Lamino would be sent to, either for hiding or for disposal. Blound also figured the village could be a trap, and Lamino the lure. Priority number one was still Lamino. For the gamblers, it was remaining undetected. To do this, they exited the back of the house they appropriated and headed opposite the direction Blound and Lamino headed before creating their paths to escape the village to Cimeterium, where no police could pass the density of the populace for them. Now the gamblers, in two separate groups, had made it to the city and were moving through it as though snakes in water. Blound, still in Ridgefloor Village, was hunting down Lamino with the nimble fidelity of a mongoose. The distance between them was growing ever smaller. The dust in the air was parting as Blound increased speed. Lamino stumbled and barely managed to move his feet as though they were an order of magnitude heavier than their reality. The gambler case was loss after loss. The weight had begun to crush Blound's posture. This situation was just another pebble on his chest. So it was with grand ferocity that Blound searched. It was also with grand ferocity that Blound's whole body elated at the sight of Lamino. His first impression was that the young officer looked vaguely as if he'd been coming down from a vicious high by way of designer drugs. He'd seen it before. Nen was the answer he was looking for, though, a particular Hatsu that would explain this all away. Mere chance, that was what it was. Blound wanted to move Lamino somewhere out of sight from the rest of the village. He struggled for a quick and easy sight to let Lamino rest lest he keep walking. Knowing that many of these houses were repossessed or abandoned, he carried Lamino's weight from door to door and found one unlocked. If there was anyone inside, they'd surely understand two officers needing assistance. No one came to see them, though. Blound set Lamino down inside against the wall. He began walking in further to try and find if there were any owners. He reached towards a lamp to turn it on for illumination, hoping it would still work. Surprisingly, he felt heat from the bulb on his hand without touching the bulb. This meant that the light would have to have been on. When the light came on, he expected to be attacked. However, his jerking turns of his head revealed an empty house. The back door was left open and dirt covered the floor. The smell of sweat still lingered, This house was occupied recently. Back in the city, Group 2 was nearing the edge of Cemeterium First. This was pure chance, as Group 1 was also near. While Dahlia was making her way out of the city, Lahara and Alexander were nearing the town hall, where they'd be able to check records and talk with the mayor. Needles was not concerned about Lahara. He felt as though he'd comfortably be able to take her out if she posed any kind of threat to Alexander, but also felt as though she wouldn't be attacking him. When Dahlia was near, Needles knew he could kill her easily, but with Lahara there as well, it would be difficult to take out two targets. This was only an issue because of some deep-seated darkness permeating from her from time to time. Lahara did not have this. What Needles saw was a young girl with a fire fueling her. She trusted Alexander and seemed to be able to put herself in a position to depend on him. Needles did not care for Alexander's trust. Not that there was a history of it, but he knew that Alexander was too trusting of people and worried that this could put them both in danger. The life of the creature made of pointed metal objects was always to be on guard. Guard, with the promise of a brutal counter. Entering the building was not a problem. The main lobby was open to the public, as they knew. The issue would come from gaining access to the mayor for Lahara and access to the records for Alexander. They both planned on sneaking to where they'd need to, should it come to it. First steps inside were cool. The air conditioning was working hard for the settings in this humid land. Alexander promptly asked the receptionist if they could speak with the mayor.
That would be unlikely,
the expected response. Lahara wanted to add her motivation in.
I would like to negotiate a trade agreement with Cowtip.
Okay, that's nice, but...
Could you at least tell him I'm here for that?
Lahara wanted to try anything properly before finding a less than legal means of beginning the talks.
Okay, anything else?
Alexander continued.
Can we see the records room?
It was a classic business tactic. The more severe option was delivered first, so that the second would seem easier or less consequential by comparison. The receptionist clearly felt bad about denying them a chance to see the mayor.
All right, but only for an hour. We'll be closing the door soon, when it gets dark. The storm might bring dangerous winds and flooding, so everyone will be advised to find shelter. That includes us.
For 15 minutes, Lahara and Alexander tried their best to acclimate themselves to the primitive technology of the records room. Learning how to use the equipment to pass the material was more difficult than actually searching. A name caught the attention of Alexander: Vivian Claude. While he was reading that article, Lahara found another name she thought she'd heard before. She saw something about someone with the last name Niall. She was skimming, despite it not being their immediate objective. While she was locked in on the paper, Alexander seemed to have read exactly what he wanted and had a visible reaction. His physical jolt surprised both Needles and Lahara. It was like the very thing he was looking for was staring Alexander straight in the face. It was an obituary. The paper was quite old, but it did include details on Vivian's life in Cowtip. Most importantly, it talked about how much she enjoyed living in Ridgefloor Village. This was before the residential area was abandoned by the powers that be, and subsequently transformed into the socio-economic pit that it currently is. His eyes delighted. As Lahara looked at him in this moment, her attention seized by his sudden excitement, she could see and feel his glow. Needles, however, was worried that Alexander had put himself into a state of vulnerability, and that Lahara had been the type to patiently wait for an opportunity to strike, that this was one such chance. But when Needles examined Lahara, he saw only a young girl with admiration, even a touch of jealousy manifesting around the edges of her mouth. She wondered if she'd get to experience the same thing. One major step had been taken for Alexander, who now knew where to look next and narrow down the scope of his search. Lahara was still where she was before, unmoving. The time limit that had been imposed on them was nearing its end. Before today, Rafferji's group was still searching for Shivra Niall. They had been dropped off a little bit from the shore and walked through the shallows to dry land. Diffey was very uncomfortable being soaked. Several other members were also annoyed, but they saw no benefit from complaining. Diffey spoke up.
This sucks!
Law expected Maida to perform his usual reply to set her in place. He did not, and the entire group felt his absence. It troubled Law to see Maida so apathetic. so Law decided to take the place.
Complaining about it only makes it worse for everyone else.
Difei was quiet. Maida actually seemed to approve of what he said. Neither Kometa nor Rafa added to the exchange. It was best to let it die down peacefully. The next action was to find the pawn shop that Sonny had informed Rafa of in the sub. It was dark when they showed up, so there wasn't anyone around to see them come out of the water, else it might cause concern. The group made their way through Fisher's Paradise and on towards the edge of Cimeterium. Kometa felt the need to ask Maida what was wrong. Law knew that this would frustrate Maida, who would not want to feel like he was causing worry. She knew that as well, but still.
Maida, is everything okay?
He took a minute, deciding if he wanted to speak.
You all seem so eager to rush into this fight. None of you realize that I'm the one that needs to heal you up. I won't forget the injuries after that fight on the coastline last year.
Diom felt offended.
But that was before Law and I joined you guys. You're better off now.
Maida continued.
We've been taking increasingly dangerous risks recently. I just want you guys to be more careful, so that I don't have to bail you out of a slow death.
Difei decided to add her opinion.
I won't be getting a slow death. In this group, those that die will die quickly, from the fight. The injured will make it out, thanks to you.
Rafa felt the need to reinterpret.
What she's saying is that in a fight, if we lose, we'll die quickly. I apologize for relying on you so much, but we don't have many options when it comes to healing.
Maida was quiet. Difei seemed annoyed by the fact that he was taking issue with their behavior. Kometa wanted to prevent further dissent amongst the group.
As long as we are smart, we can depend on each other to avoid both death and injury. Callens was right earlier. We can't be too careful.
The group was mostly silent on the rest of the walk to the pawn shop. Even Hass, who enjoyed meaningless conversation, was silent, thinking over Maida's concerns. It was finally time for them to enter the shop.
Who's going in?
Rafa wanted to organize beforehand, as the shop was too small for all of them to fit inside.
I'm going in.
Diom wanted to work his way further into the group's trust.
Nah, I'm going in.
Hass obstructed his motives. Rafa dispelled both of them.
Kometa and Sony are coming in. Maida and Callens wait by the door. The rest of you stay by the shop and wait for us to finish up. Keep an eye out on the surroundings.
Law understood his methodology. He could see that Rafa was relying on Maida and Callens' protective natures in the event that either someone outside or inside needed help. Law figured Rafa knew he was in the group for the fight, but not in the same way as Difei or Hass. Sony was an obvious choice to go in, as he had the most knowledge and the most connections. Kometa might as well have been assumed the moment Rafa indicated he was going to enter. Deom wanted to be face to face with the group's obstacles, as was his nature. However, in the event that the group was ambushed, it was necessary for the more destructive members to be outside at this time. If Deom were to use his ability indoors, he might wind up putting Rafa and Kometa at risk. As Law waited, he guessed at what they were asking. Knowing what the group needed, he assumed that one question would be the location of Shivra and the other would be a place to hide out. He made a mental note of the pawn shop's location and purpose, should he need to use it again at a later date. Candy was passing by the pawn shop on her way to the CPD station. She was unaware that currently the building was empty, as all the officers were either at the hospital in Ridge Floor Village or in Fisher's Paradise, waiting for the gamblers to try and make their escape. Still, she walked. Behind her, down the street a ways, two people had been following her. They had overheard a conversation she had in a bar they were in. She was too stuck in her own thoughts to notice they were following with curiosity in their minds. They didn't slow as she approached the police station. Worry entered her head as she walked up to the entrance. Candy had no idea what kind of people she'd run into in the station. With a deep breath, she entered. Inside, she saw no one. The station was devoid of any police. The only other person in the station at the moment was Baruka, but neither of them knew that the other was there. The station remained open during day hours to allow for people to come in and file or otherwise report with the police. It was their duty. No one was there to fulfill that duty at this time, however. Checking the bathrooms and the other rooms she had access to, she came to understand the situation. As she was contemplating her next move, two people entered the front entrance behind her. Startled, Candy turned to face them. It was Cern and Zero. Zero had recognized her from the ferry ride to Cowtip in the bar. After that, he listened in on her conversations with Whisk and Horn. Cern, having picked up on what Zero was doing, did the same. No one had even the slightest inclination towards violence inside a police station, yet there was still a tension in the air.
What are you doing here?
She remained calm. Cern led their response.
We could ask the same. Shiver Night Owl, huh?
Zero cared not if she remembered him.
Are you two looking for Shiver Nyarl?
To be honest.
Zero wasn't sure of Cern's intentions just yet.
I'm looking for Gorik Huntsman.
He paused, waiting for a reply. Her silence indicated to him that she didn't, in fact, know him. So he continued to ponder why she was here.
You still haven't answered us.
Cern wanted something to do after coming here with Zero. Candy saw no reason to lie. She was in a hurry to share the knowledge she had.
I'm looking for the police to tell them something I know.
Before anyone else could say anything, the phone rang. Neither person moved to pick it up. None of them were police, so they felt like they should let it go to the machine. So they all waited, as each rang somehow diffused the situation more and more. Yet a new tension persisted. Which ring would be the last one? Then there were no more rings.
Hello? I don't know if anyone's still in the station, or if everyone's left for Fisher's Paradise already, but I'll leave this message in case you get back before I do.
There was some shuffling, like feet on hardwood flooring with some light dirt between.
I've found Lamino. I'm in a house that looks like it could have been their hideout. I don't know if they're still in Ridgefloor Village, though. I wanted to leave this message because I'm going to leave Lamino here and search for them. He's in no condition to move and is passed out. He seemed to be under some kind of control, but it's worn off now. He's exhausted. I'll let you know what I find. Time is of the essence, otherwise I wouldn't leave him. I'm going to call Officer Saf to come watch him while I follow these Nen trails. I hope everything's going well with the operation. See you soon. Bye.
After hanging up, it seemed as though no one wanted to be the first to speak. Everyone was waiting for everyone else to respond like some bystander dilemma deadlock. Finally, Cern broke the air.
Where are you going, Zero?
It sounds like Gorik will be in Fisher's Paradise.
The situation in Ridge Floor sounds interesting. I'll let you know if I find anything fun. I'll let you do your thing with that Gorik guy, but please, please, let me know if you are having too much fun for one person. I'm taking a stab in the dark with Ridge Floor.
Absolutely.
Zero wanted to keep Cern as an ally, as he knew firsthand of his strengths. Cern then proceeded to exit the front door and began traveling rather quickly towards Ridge Floor Village. Zero and Candy were left inside the station, still awaiting each other's speech.
So, he left. What about you?
I'm going to talk to the police as well.
Zero wanted to speak to Gorik, specifically to ask about his past.
Fisher's Paradise.
Yep. Would it be rude if I asked you to accompany me there?
Zero grinned.
Well, no.
Then along the way. I'd like it if you could tell me whatever you know about this Shiver guy.
Alexander and Lahara were getting themselves ready to leave the building. After discovering the location of the next step in Alexander's search, they decided the Ridge Floor Village would be their next destination. They approached the door. Meanwhile, Mayor Gray stepped out.
You must be Lahara.
She turned around to face him.
Yes, that's me.
The receptionist was looking ashamed as Gray continued.
I've just been informed that you would like to discuss a trade deal. Your timing couldn't be more perfect, Miss Lahara.
Alexander felt glad for her.
This is your chance. I can look around in Ridge Floor myself. Just call me when you're done here.
Lahara shook her head as Alexander stepped out. Inside, Lahara was now going up the stairs to Mayor Gray's office to discuss the bare-bones plans and to arrange a proper meeting for it in the future, utilizing their limited time in the current day. Outside, Needles was glad.
She'd just have slowed you down anyways.
The natural speed Alexander possessed would make the trip alone much quicker. He would arrive in Ridge Floor in minutes. With a clenched foot, he pushed the air behind him, frictioning across the ground as his body was propelled forward into his long strides. Each step was a clap against the ground, his head leading him as he attempted to reduce wind resistance. There was little pressure on his feet now that he was in full stride, legs swinging with powerful leaps. Invisible, Needles flew behind him. Mayor Gray sat down in his office where he'd recently spoken to Chief Rether. Lahara breezed past his assistant and took the seat opposite the desk from the mayor. She peered around, taking in the room, noting the Fidori painting, the waste bin, the shelf, and its collection of books meant to impress, though unlikely it was that Gray actually read any of them. Had her family their esteem, still, this would be an hilariously one-sided affair, as Lahara was literally royalty, and Gray, a small-time mayor and representative of Cowtip. Instead, she was an out-of-towner talking to the highest authority in the land. She still felt the former, while Gray only saw the latter. This was an uphill climb, she knew, yet she was glad to have the opportunity at all. Anya, Virgil, Lore, and Jeremiah were almost to Fisher's paradise. Jeremiah and Lore had been staying in a hut in the village after what had happened in Cimeterium with the rest of the group. Virgil was wondering just what had happened to them.
Hey, so how did you get split up from the rest of this group you mentioned?
Jeremiah coldly.
They all got sent to their graves while Law and I got left behind.
From here, Anya was ready to know what happened as Lore began to elaborate.
It went like this.
Rafa and Sonny walked the group to the empty building where they'd be staying as they searched. This would be their base of operations. They would mostly move in shifts, leaving someone there as separate groups went about searching for Shivra. Not long after they began, Shivra was spotted roaming the outside of the Ridgefloor village. With a plan devised by the members of the group, Rafa and Jeremiah decided to be the bait. Jeremiah was necessary for this role due to his ability. They planned on cornering him in a small environment so he'd have nowhere to run and no way to use too destructive of abilities. This also meant that Deom would not be able to use his expanding explosion ability. The group came to the conclusion that he must have come here in search of something and had not found it. Their plan was simply to allude to the fact that they knew what he was looking for, lead him to the building, and ambush him. The original idea was to subdue him, but most of the members wanted to kill, as was their objective given to them. Sonny wanted him alive to question him for details on the operation that he was a part of. Rafa and Jeremiah got into view of Shivra Niarl, and Jeremiah made contact from his maximum range, locking him into view with his staring contest ability. From there, Rafa announced to him that they knew what he was looking for. Unsure if this plan would work, the two were mildly surprised when he complied and started calmly moving towards them. When they got him inside the building, Rafa quietly said,
"I'm sorry."
The room was pungent with malevolent intent. Law would need to move in close to be able to let his talents shine, else he keep distance for his own protection, using his aura burn ability. Rafa's first move was to distance himself from Shivra, where Jeremiah and he were still the closest ones. Rafa accomplished this by darting away to a corner with Cullens. With Jeremiah backing away, Shivra didn't even attempt to turn and run. Instead, he stepped into the middle of the room, his back to the door. To prevent him from moving away from the center, Kometa conjured a cage around Shivra. Unfazed, he searched for who caused it, catching a glimpse of Kometa, still in the motions of her Hatsu. With her in his sights, Dife rushed forward, looking to end the altercation instantly. While this was occurring, both Rafa and Hass figured they would use Dife's attack as a distraction to prepare their own attacks on Shivra. If she was not able to kill him with her knife, Hass would poison him while Rafa launched his blast while he was still caged. Rafa began charging as Cullens looked for who he should swap with first. Deom placed himself in the corner opposite Rafa so that Cullens could switch places with Deom and then from Deom's position swap with Rafa, effectively teleporting Rafa mid-charge. Part of Rafa's conditions is that he cannot move while he charges, but the longer he charges, the stronger his electrical fire blast becomes. He would wait to recite the phrase that supercharges it until he was ready to launch it, though. Dife had previously been giving her speed to Jeremiah to move into the corner with Deom, who could protect him. Now she was using her speed boost on herself to attack Shivra directly in the cage as he focused on Kometa. Hass was attacking from the opposite direction at a much slower pace, and with poison instead. Sonny waited with Lore, as his ability, like Deom's, would only hamper the group in this environment. Maida waited in the corner with Deom and Jeremiah, cautiously guessing what his move should be. As Dife, with her unbelievable speed, was almost within striking distance of Shivra, as he faced away from her, he swung his arm in her direction, shattering the cage, and, while the force of his movement also pulled pieces of debris with it, he swung into her, crushing her body as her skull was shattered and fragmented, its contents being forced downward, through her neck, into the pudding that the force of his attack was making inside her body. Most of her bones broke as she was thrown into the ground, folded up and lifeless. As this happened, Kalns almost attempted to swap with her, to which Rafa shouted him down. Within this moment, Hass was coming up on Shivra, now free from the cage. With speed surpassing even Difa's, Shivra turned and ducked as Hass led with a punch. Underneath his blow, Shivra grasped at one of Hass's legs and picked him up. With a rabid ferocity, he swung him like a club, his face and arm colliding with the ceiling before coming down on the ground, splattering him apart. Rafa decided to skip the recital and launched his attack. But Shivra had already set his sight on the next victim. He strode forward at incredible speed. It was a wonder to Maida and Soni how Kameta managed to conjure her wall in time, but she did, which allowed her to swap with Kalns just in time. Rafa's attack missed, launching straight at Deom and Jeremiah, who were lucky to avoid the attack which damaged the walls, but wasn't charged long enough, nor did it include the recital, so it was devoid of the strength to destroy the walls. Shivra's attack shattered Kameta's wall, sending pieces of it flying into Kalns. Had the pieces hit Jeremiah, Soni, Kameta, or even Rafa, and they would have been dead. Kameta and Rafa were now in the same corner, and Rafa prepared to charge another attack, while Kameta was ready to put a wall up as soon as he fired it. Mida began his move to attempt to heal Kalns. It was during this time that Soni tried to make it out the door to the outside. Shivra noticed this, however, and smeared him against the wall with a kick from the side after moving fast enough to avoid visible detection from the untrained eye. Sonny's blood covered the windows on that face of the room, darkening the interior. Jeremiah, now drenched with blood, began slowly moving along the ground towards Law, who was trying to find any aura to burn, but he couldn't see any being used. He was stuck on the defensive for now. It occurred to him that either Shivra was hiding his Nen, or he wasn't emitting any and was using physical attacks. Maida managed to make it to Kalns, who was hurt, but not out of the count just yet. As Shivra was back near the door, Law saw an opportunity to use his Aura Burn Lance to try and drain Nen directly from Shivra with the Nen-made fire coming from his palm. This was when the group noticed that Shivra was surrounded by an orb of Nen hidden with Ian. At first, Law was able to burn part of it away, but then Shivra began emitting at a faster rate, overcoming the burn time of Law's ability. Before Shivra could counter-attack Law, Rafa launched his attack at Shivra, followed by Kameta setting up the wall in front of them both. Shivra caught the attack with his invisible Nen as if they were hands and smothered it. Then, with a motion of a punch, sent an invisible wave of Nen at their corner. As he swung, the corpses of Hass and Soni were dragged along and tossed about by the Nen. Law saw the trajectory of their bodies in motion and launched an aura burn roar from his fist in the direction he thought the Nen would hit him from. As he suspected, he was able to burn the invisible Nen away before it hit him. This didn't stop his attack from reaching the true target, however. The attack reached Kometa's wall and burst through it. Kalns was not yet healed enough to swap with either one, though he wondered which he should choose if he could. The attack continued through the wall and forced the bodies of both Rafa and Kometa to contort down into the corner of the room. After this, Shivra was facing Kalns and Maida. He knew that Maida was healing, and saw this as an obstacle. Law knew what Shivra was going to do and yelled out,
"Kalns, switch with me!"
To which Kalns replied,
"Survive!"
Angered, Law began emitting his lance from his palm at Shivra, whose orb was gone at this time. Law speculated that he might only be able to use his aura in one way at a time. With a direct kick, Shivra sent Maida flying into the wall with such a force that his body popped on impact. Shivra had not yet noticed Law draining his Nen yet. Jeremiah managed to make it to Law as Kalns was thrown to the side near Deom. Deom had been charging his Nen and was now happy to have a chance to show off.
"I'm going to take him down!"
Kalns knew what he was going to attempt.
"No, Deom, you'll kill everyone else."
"Everyone else? Everyone's already dead. I'm bringing this fucker with us."
Law took Jeremiah and moved closer to the wall, hiding Jeremiah behind his body. Deom began emitting a powerful raw energy from his body. Kalns scrambled to get away before he was killed. Shivra felt this energy and immediately acted. With his invisible Nen, he cupped his aura around Deom like hands grasping a fallen bird and began to close the barriers in on him. Law, still draining Shivra's Nen, began trying to sever the aura coming from Shivra. It was a tense decision, as if he had succeeded, Deom's attack might have killed both Jeremiah and Law anyways. He was unable to break the Nen attack, and Deom was slowly crushed to death before their very eyes. Kalns was disoriented and had accidentally dove towards Shivra in his attempts to escape Deom. Shivra picked him up by the throat, one-handed. He turned to face Law, Law could see the look on Kalnes' face as he was being choked. It was the same as when he shouted for Law to survive. As Kalnes and Law met, eye to eye, Law grabbed the back of Jeremiah's shirt. With a nod, Law gave Kalnes the comfort that he had a plan. Shivra crushed his throat until he was grabbing only at Kalnes' spine. Law then stopped draining Shivra's Nen and yelled up at the ceiling,
"Now's your chance! Come through the roof!"
Shivra dropped the corpse of Kalnes and immediately looked towards the ceiling. With just a quick thought, he jumped through the ceiling, wondering what this trump card might have been. In the air, he noticed a man in the alleyway coming towards the garage, but he was no Nen user. It was a member of the gambling ring, scouting out locations. He would later mark this one as a void, along with any that were taken over by homeless drug users. As he saw Shivra launch into the sky, he reflexively turned back and ran. Shivra wondered if that was the other group member that Law was communicating with. In reality, there was no one else. As soon as Shivra preemptively attacked, Law, carrying Jeremiah, pounced out of the door, leaving it locked from the inside so that it would look as it did before when they locked Shivra inside. Throwing the door open and locking it while opened with one hand, no deadbolt available, he dragged Jeremiah with the other hand and dashed across the street while Shivra examined the gambler. It was due to Law's expert training that he was aware of the gambler nearby. Law and Jeremiah hid themselves with Zetsu and made their way through Cemeterium to a place where they could wash the blood off of themselves. The whole ordeal took no more than a minute or two. Shivra had lost the will to pursue and knew not where to begin looking. Instead, he put distance between himself and the city, expecting a major backlash from what had happened. What really happened was that the police would discover the location without any knowledge of Shivra's involvement. Law and Jeremiah still expected Shivra to be near Ridge Floor Village, so they paid a local fisher to use a shack as a place of residence in Fisher's Paradise, on the opposite end of Cemeterium from Shivra.
"And I've been looking for others ever since."
Anya gesticulated the rest.
"Other Nen users to help you take down Shivra, right?"
"Precisely.
I want revenge on that bastard,"
added Jeremiah. But revenge wasn't the only thing on Law's mind. He had originally joined Rafa's group to get a chance to fight powerful people and defeat them. Shivra was simply the next foe to be defeated. Law would make sure of it. Group 1 of the gamblers now made it to the border between Cemeterium and Fisher's Paradise. Tolva and another from the group stepped forward. They had sensed an ambush just inside the village. Maxwell, taking this opportunity away from Tolva for a second, moved out of the open to an alleyway where he could both watch and escape easily. Just inside the village, Gorik and Kasumi were waiting behind structures for the group to enter. Chief Rether was sent to the docks to arrest anyone who attempted to flee. Due to not having any Nen abilities, he was separated from Gorik and Kasumi, who would be the first line of defense, any moment now, and they'd be ready to strike. Gorik signaled to Kasumi silently about the two men walking towards the entrance to the village. Tulva knew he'd be entering combat any moment. Maxwell wanted to see what would happen, but vowed to stay out of the altercation since the police were involved. The situation was a powder keg, as neither Gorik nor Kasumi wanted to give away their positions with the first strike. The tension grew. Elsewhere, heading towards this situation, Zero and Candy were leisurely strolling. Detective Blound was hot on the trail of some Nen users, leading him directly to the border between Cemeterium and Fisher's Paradise. Law, Jeremiah, Virgil and Anya were all heading into Fisher's Paradise as well. The small village was taking in powerful fighters, and the situation seemed to only be getting worse by the minute.